Jesus challenges us today to reflect on sight. Sight is one of our most dominant senses, and so much of our world is dominated by it. But we often don't think about how often we are deceived by it, how often we realize that the things out there are either cultivated by what people want us to see, or by our own ideologies, our concepts of things. How often, although it's out there as its own, we conceptualize things, we change them, we manipulate them to match what we want it to be, not what it truly is. In this way, Jesus is not teaching us about sight, but spiritual sight, something very different. The insights that are within us, that came from God, that help us keep everything in its proper places, that help us to know the things of God, that is not dominated by physical sight, but something different, a spiritual sense. As we walk through this gospel and Jesus teaches us about the value of spiritual sight, there's four main movements of this play that help us understand what he has done. Now you may think, why not three? Well, part of it is I chose four. But I also argue that there is actually four movements, not three. Three is a number of perfection. It would mean it's complete. Four is a number of imperfection, meaning that this gospel always calls us to continual conversion. It challenges us again and again to seek deeper the issue of spiritual sight. So the first part of our play, we have the man who is born blind sitting on the road begging. He doesn't say anything. Instead, the disciples start this dialogue. Jesus noticing him, the disciples noticing that, ask him a question. Why is he blind? What happened to him? Now notice all the different parts come together. This guy is just sitting by the road begging. He's not doing anything. In most of Jesus' miracles, the people come up to him and ask for something. Not this case. Instead, something more profound is about to happen. In the same way, we need to chronicle the ways we talk about this man. He starts as the man born blind. Then he becomes the blind man. Last, he becomes the one who has gained his sight. All these things drive us to really recognize the value of this particular person in the midst of this entire event. To Jesus, he is a man. To the disciples, he is blind. To the Pharisees, he is nothing but blind. To us, he is the man who has gained his sight. In all these different ways, this particular part challenges us to see the world differently. How often do we judge someone by their characteristics and limit them by saying, "This is who you are"? How rarely do we actually look at a person and recognize what is going on within them, the value, the dignity they have? How rarely do we realize that someone is actually there to glorify God? That is their point, and miss that in the midst of how we treat each other. The first part of this story challenges us to realize that our sights often mislead us and don't let us see the true value of what's before us. That leads to the second part, the miracle itself, a weird event of its own. Jesus spits on the ground, makes clay out of his saliva, and smears on the guy's eyes and says, "Go wash." I want to emphasize how radically strange this particular event is. First of all, the fact that Jesus spat on the ground is enough. It's kind of gross. Then he makes clay out of it. This poor guy is sitting there, and all of a sudden he's smeared with this stuff on his eyes and told to go find this pool. Keep in mind, he's blind. How does he know how to get there? So let's go a little bit deeper. The idea of Jesus making clay out of the ground is not novel. It goes back to the book of Genesis, where God, in forming Adam, forms Adam out of the clay and breathes into him. Part earth, part God. What is this clay? Part earth, part God. Clay and saliva. In this way, we have to see what Jesus is doing as not this kind of weird, strange event or some weird ritual, but as hearkening back to Adam and creating a new creation. He's not just giving him sight. He's creating brand new eyes. That's different. So now, smeared with all this, he's given a command. Go wash. And so, now that he has a new spiritual sense within him, he can find the pool without a problem. He knows where it is. He has a sense of where he ought to be. He doesn't just go to a pool and wash off his eyes. What he's doing is teaching us something about the value of baptism. Since we use the word wash, we have to see all that connected with baptism. This man isn't just given sight. He's given spiritual sight. He can see the world differently now. He has the gift of faith. That should challenge us. In baptism, we didn't just celebrate a ritual and say, "Congratulations, you're part of our community. Well done." No, baptism gives graces, and we often don't reflect enough on the virtues we were given, the very spiritual gifts given at baptism, one of them being spiritual sight. We see the world differently now. We see it through the eyes of faith. We recognize that God is doing more in our world than we anticipated, and now He has gifted us with that ability to put the things together, to see the world in its totality as created by God. This is spiritual sight. With that in mind, we go to the third part. In the third part, the Pharisees find him, and they're perplexed by this for lots of reasons. One being, this man cured on the Sabbath, and that's a no-no. Second, that he all of a sudden had sight, and now claiming that Jesus did something about this. So they question him. He goes under scrutiny. Why and how did this happen? And I want you to notice the dualities and conflicts that happen in this passage. First of all, we have the man born blind, who is in the light. He is the one who sees clearly. He's the one that gets it, even though he was at one point blind. The Pharisees are the ones who live in darkness. They don't get it. Everything for them has to fit within their worldview. The man, as he answers their questions, does something that we didn't necessarily pay attention to. He always speaks the truth. He never deviates. He never changes his story. It's always the same. He says it point by point the same each time, even to the point where when they ask him again, he's like, I already told you. What more can I say? If you didn't want to listen to me, not my problem. Figure it out. And he never embellishes it any way. When they ask him who Jesus is, he's like, he's a prophet. That's what prophets do. They do things like this and it works. What else am I supposed to call him? He also never tries to add on to the story and say things like, oh, no, he can't be a sinner. He's a good man. He did this for me. Nope. Here's my story. I'm sticking to it. It's the Pharisees who are the most fascinating. They're the ones who are trying to reshape this story and twist it to fit their worldview. They're trying to push their ideologies on this to make Jesus an evil man by saying he cured on the Sabbath. He must be a sinner. He must be like this. Their judgments are pushed upon this story to the point where it takes away all of its merit. Challenge for us. How often do we do things like this? We change the world around us to fit our ideologies. We reshape what we see, what we know, so that it fits what we want it to be, not what it is. To give you a few examples of what I mean is how faith shapes the world around us and helps us see it as it truly is, not as something we want it to be. I don't know if you know this, but the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops produces a document every year on how we ought to vote. More specifically, it takes each of the issues up for voting and explains how they work in the life of faith, so that we can see how the church is encouraging us to see all of what we deal with in our society in light of our faith. A more exciting example for me is the interplay between science and faith. I don't think most people realize this. We are one of the only faiths in the world that see no conflict between faith and science. The only other one being Judaism. All the other ones find them at odds with each other. We don't. And here's why. If God created everything, everything in the universe, he didn't just go, poof, it's in existence. Yay, it's done. No, he imbued it with logic and reasoning. He expected that the creation would follow his laws and patterns, and us, as people endowed with reason, would be able to see these things and recognize the logic, the reasoning behind the entire universe. Through reason and knowing the universe, we'd come to understand God better. All of that was part of his system. He built it so it would be knowable. That's shocking to think about. So when we play with the idea of evolution, which everyone kind of has their different camps on, and I certainly do as someone who has a degree both in biology and theology, I can speak on this. So I ask you a question. Which is more impressive? That God could say, poof, everything is the way it is. It's just set and static. Or that God could create a system so brilliant that he could make all of his creatures adapt to every changing environment, working always to make humans the pinnacle of creation. So that from the beginning of time, he created an entire system to make us the highest of all creatures. I know where I stand. That's up to you now. But nevertheless, notice what I didn't say. I didn't say we evolved from apes. Why? Because it's still debated. Neither did I say that creation and evolution are just kind of at odds with each other, nor are they contending with each other. That God put all of this system together. He created it all. There's no deception there. So there's our challenge. This third part challenges us to realize that our faith informs the way we see the world and can help us put everything in a proper place so we see all of creation in its totality, not as something separate or weird, but always in the light of God. The last part of our saga has the man kicked out of the synagogue. He's kicked out. Now what? Jesus comes up to him. I want to make a point. He has never seen Jesus. Remember, after Jesus smeared his eyes with the clay, he left and didn't come back. So this is the first time he's actually seen him. He doesn't know what he looks like yet. And so Jesus comes up and says, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" What a great starting question. What does that mean? But the guy already has faith. He already understands this. So he acts in faith by saying, "Who is he that I may believe in him?" Jesus says, "I am he." Notice how much this has changed. The man went from a guy begging by the side of the road to a person who called him a prophet to now worshiping him. That is an incredible conversion. And by finally encountering Jesus as a person of faith, he worships. Basically, Jesus, by coming to him again, confirms his faith. This is a sacrament of confirmation. He seals what he already believed in him, that he may not lose that light of faith within him and be able to use it to see the world properly. Which challenges us. How well do we really see the world? Are we blinded to too many things that we really don't see well? Jesus' last phrase is always fascinating to me. The Pharisees are upset and they say, "We're not blind, are we?" Well, if you're sinful, then you can see. But if you have no sin, then you're blind and you're actually better off that way. It's actually comical. We should almost laugh at some of the points because they're so wonderfully brilliant and transformative in this passage. How well do we see the world? How much do we shape what we think by our ideologies, by what we want the world to be? Does our faith inform us on the world around us, or is it just something separate from everything else? Our goal is to see and see clearly, not be blinded by what we have, but allow the light of faith to permeate everything we do and allow us to see everything in light of what God sees.